Welcome to Happily Family. I'm Cecilia
And
Hilke,
I'm Jason Hilke.
and we are delighted today to have Dr. Daniel Siegel with us. Dan is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the executive director of the MindSight Institute. He has authored or co-authored several books, including Parenting from the Inside Out, The Whole Brain Child, Brainstorm, The Yes Brain, The Power of Showing Up, and Interconnected. Welcome, Dan. It's great to have you
Thanks for
here.
being here again, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Cecilia and Jason. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
I wanted to start by asking you a question about parenting teens. This is a question that we encounter a lot in our community, where parents want to help the teenager, but the teen does not want help. And then a dynamic happens where the teen gets more anxious and stressed and reactive, and yet the parent isn't allowed to help. What advice do you have for this sort of dynamic?
Well, first of all, you're not alone. That's the first thing to remember. I think when I wrote the book Brainstorm, it was to try to address this very kind of question. I mean, I wrote it for adolescents themselves to read. Excuse me. But, first of all, having a sense of humor. So, like this cup, a dear friend of mine gave it to me. It's manna tea.
Nice.
We had just visited the manatees in Florida. And you got to have a sense of humor working with adolescents, knowing it's very serious business, growing from the dependency of childhood to the responsibility of adulthood. It's not easy. It's never been easy, but these days the world is in a really rough place. And so recognizing that, we as the adults have an opportunity to look at difficulties and not just to say it in a smoothing it over way, but really see them as opportunities. And the opportunity of difficult communication is to allow it to be a learning experience for both you and your adolescent. So I would take a step back and just ask you, what is the trouble in the communication? And if you're getting reactive and intensely going after your kid with wanting to fight them or wanting to run away from them, the classic fight or flee. Sometimes we even freeze up. We don't know what to do, and we just give kind of stern looks, and that's terrifying too. And that gets our adolescent to be more reactive. So just know that the brain for you and for your adolescent has two states, a reactive state and a receptive state. And the best parenting is done when you yourself are in a receptive state of mind. This means you're open, ready to connect. I remember with the acronym COLE, you're curious, you're open, accepting, and you're loving, even if you're frustrated. So bringing that COLE state, curiosity, what's going on with my adolescent? What's going on with me? Openness, I'm inviting anything in, bring it on. When whatever comes, comes, like, oh my God, I'm remembering my parents didn't treat me well when I was a kid, and now my adolescent is acting just like my brother did, which used to happen, in my own personal life. Then I want to accept this is what's happening in my imagery that's arising inside of me. And I want to come to my own inner life with a loving attitude of kindness and care. And when we start with that COLE frame, curious, open, accepting, and loving, then we're ready to go to our adolescent with whatever interaction that particular thing, that moment is calling for. And to do it not in a way that we would have if our 16-year-old was six, but a 16-year-old is not just a six-year-old with 10 more years. They're in a whole different, literally, brain state of remodeling and also developmental state of getting ready for responsibility as an adult, which, by the way, won't happen till they're in their mid to late 20s. So it takes a while. It's not just the teen years, but adolescence goes into the mid to late 20s.
So in the acronym, one of the questions I had, and we hear this from parents as well, around the acceptance, is that they're afraid that it means that they have to agree, or that if they're that they're condoning it, or that they're going along with it. Could you talk a little bit about, like, how does a parent be accepting but about something that maybe they don't agree with, or they're afraid something's going to happen to their kid if they're too accepting, like they're going to turn out in a certain way that they don't want.
You know, Jason, I'm so glad you're asking that, because acceptance is not approval. It's also not being passive. So I'll give you an example of the younger child, so it's not going to be so activating for any adolescent, any parent of an adolescent listening. Let's say your six-year-old really wants ice cream before dinner, and she starts pouting because you're not going to give her ice cream before dinner. Now, the curious way is you say, you know, what's going on with you? Oh, she wants ice cream. You're open to the fact that, you know, ice cream's got sugar, ice cream's got fat. You know, an ice cream has two of the big ingredients. Salt would be the a third one. You know, that our brain is like designed to kind of go after, and you get a dopamine hit when you get that. So she's an animal that wants that stuff. And of course, companies that sell ice cream or, you know, salty, greasy potato chips, they know how to get your dopamine going, get you wanting and craving this stuff. So your child, that six-year-old wanting the ice cream before dinner, you're curious. Okay, that's what's going on. You're open. You say, what's actually happening? My six-year-old's wanting ice cream before dinner. I didn't raise her to do like that. Well, that wouldn't be being open. You're just open. This is what's happening. Now, here's the acceptance piece you're asking about. The acceptance that she wants ice cream is to say, I was curious and open. This is what arose. My daughter really wants ice cream before dinner, against everything I've ever taught her for 6 years. Now, acceptance doesn't say I'm going to give her ice cream. It says, I accept that what I see is true. She really wants this ice cream. That's what's happening. So with a loving way, I say, of course you want ice cream before dinner. I want ice cream before dinner too. And you know, the way the body works, if we eat a lot of sugary stuff before dinner, then we're not going to actually have the appetite to eat the healthy stuff. So we are going to have a little bit of ice cream afterwards. I don't know which flavor you're going to pick, but I know what I'm thinking of. She goes, I want chocolate. I want chocolate. I said, well, chocolate at night, we don't do that. But you do strawberry or vanilla, whatever you want. So we're going to do that. But the way we do it in our family is we go for the healthy alternative. So we are going to have dinner first. But of course you want your ice cream before dinner. So that would be curious, open, accepting, and loving in your response that absolutely has boundaries, and you teach the proper way to eat is not to have dessert before dinner, except maybe once in a while. Now, let's do an adolescent example. Your kid really wants to go to a party, right? So you can say, depending on your philosophy, you're not going to a party. You're 16. 16-year-olds don't go to parties, or whatever your policy might be. Well, but you'd be wrong. I mean, 16-year-olds have the essence, right? An emotional spark. They want to engage their emotions, social engagement. They want to be with their peers, you know, novelty seeking. They want to do new stuff, like a party has new people in it, and creative exploration. They're going to do creative things. That's their essence. If you want to cramp down on their essence, go for it. See what happens once they leave home, you know? So instead of doing that, you're curious. You want to go to a party? Tell me about it. They say, this is a party. There's no parents home. There's going to be lots of drugs, lots of fast cars. And it's right on a cliff, and we can jump off and jump into the street below about 300 feet. oh, that sounds good. No. So you find out the conditions of this party. And then you can say, here's the rule. You go to a party as a 16-year-old. You know, you need to leave that party by 10:30. No, I want to stay till 2. That's in our family. We don't do it that way. You get to go to a party. That's great. But the rule is 10:30. I'll pick you up. Or you can have a friend bring you home, or however you're going to do it. You have to be home by 10:45 because your party's 15 minutes away. I'm looking on the GPS, you know, 11 at the latest. If you're past 11, okay, you're not going to be able to go to a party for a month. So you choose. You want to be late and violate the rules we're agreeing to? That's your choice. So you're giving them choice and you're empowering them.
So what I thought was interesting about the examples you gave is that refers back to what you had said about the state of mind that we're in, whether we're in like a thinking part of our brain or a reactive part of our brain. And much of this using the curious, open, accepting, and loving, you got to be in the thinking part of your brain. Like, it's hard to exactly. be in the active part of your brain. I was just noticing that as you were going through all of those examples.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Cole is a way of describing that thinking, reflective, receptive state that part of the brain and that way the brain is functioning allows us to do, you know. And it's not always easy. I mean, just because we can say it doesn't mean it's easy. So it may be simple, but it's not easy. Especially, you got to figure out your own hot buttons. I mean, you know, Mary Hartson and I wrote a book, a long time ago, 22 and a half, 22, over 22 years ago. And a long time ago, we wrote this book, Parenting from the Inside Out. But it was all about saying to parents, go inward first. Because if you're reactive, no good parenting comes from reactivity. Now, I'm not saying if your three-year-old is running in the street, you don't quickly react and grab their arm. Let's be really clear. There are emergencies that require fast action. But then once you grab your three-year-old, you don't hit them or scream and yell at them. You might raise your voice and say, we don't run into streets, you know, after you've kept them safe, to give them the emotional import of what they almost did. It's a life and death thing. So I understand that. But then you quickly come back to a receptive state. So, you know, these emergencies do need fast action. That's often done out of the quick reaction of, you know, reactivity, literally. So we're not saying just exclude that or beat yourself up for doing that. But most things that happen are not running in the street kind of emergencies.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about if we know our child is struggling with some anxiety or depression. So much of your work is about showing up and our presence. And how can our presence help if our child is having a struggle with anxiety or depression?
Well, you know, I'm a psychiatrist and a child and adolescent psychiatrist also. And so these are the big things that we deal with, that there's, you know, adolescence and the challenges it presents for the adolescent themselves and for the parents of adolescents and the teachers. And then there are clinical conditions that, you know, I'm trained as a child mental health person, you know, to diagnose and then to discuss with the family, including the child or adolescent and the parents, and then figure out what's likely going on and then taking some action. So, you know, that is a clinical assessment to do. And in general terms, you know, I'll just say some broad things. Whether you're a kid or an adolescent or an adult, mostly people come with either the experience of chaos or rigidity. So all the different disorders, they're presenting troubles, if you will, the challenges are periods of chaos and rigidity. And, you know, I've written extensively about this in my field, interpersonal neurobiology, but the bottom line is, you know, you can see the mind as creating this optimal flow, which here's another acronym that has five letters, FACES, flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable, FACES, FACES. Flexible means instead of going just into chaos where you're randomly activated and overwhelmed, or rigidity where you're shut down and depleted, flexibility means you're able to go with the flow. Things change, you change your approach. You may have intense emotional reactions that look a little chaotic, then it comes back into harmony. Maybe it shuts down a little bit, then it comes back into harmony. That's flexibility. The adaptability means you figure out the best way to use your flexibility to adjust to what that situation requires. So flexibility means you bend, you don't break. Adaptability means you figure out what is the optimal way of responding given these new conditions. Like we were going to go on a trip. Oh, the trip was canceled because of the big thunderstorm or the fires or whatever. You know, you have to adapt, right? Coherence, the C of FACES, is kind of resilience. It has this wholeness to it, a groundedness, an integrated quality of feeling like, you know, I'm learning from my challenges. That would be a very resilient mind that we would call coherent in the FACES flow. And energized, the E of FACES, is you have a sense of vitality. And S is you are stable, not that you're rigid, but that you're reliable, right? Not shut down in rigidity. So FACES, flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. So what I say to my families that I work with, you know, is your child generally in a FACES flow? And they go, oh, yeah, mostly. But sometimes he comes home and he yells at me that, you know, his friend rejected him when they were going to go on a outing together. And he's so mad and he's screaming and yelling. I said, how long is that going for? 15 minutes. And then what happens? And then he comes and we play a game of poker or whatever. We eat dinner and it's fine. I said, okay, well. So he went a little bit into chaos for a little bit, like any of us do. Comes back into the flow of the river of harmony, you know. And sometimes someone shuts down, they're really upset, and they shut down for a while, and then they come back. If someone tells me they start screaming for hours and hours and hours without relief, or they're shut down in the room and feeling depleted and depressed, you know, for hours and hours and hours, then I start getting concerned. And if it's days, I get really concerned. If it's weeks, then it's a diagnosis. Literally, in the formal sense of that. So you can basically look at it as something called dysregulation. So whether you're talking about anxiety, where the feeling of fear is dysregulated, or you're talking about depression, where the feeling often of separation, distress, and sadness is dysregulated, or someone's exploding in rages, where the system of anger, you know, is dysregulated. Every form of psychiatric disorder, in addition to being chaos and rigidity, what that's telling us is that the regulation that happens in that faces flow of harmony is now pushing you either into chaos or rigidity. So all these clinical conditions are intense dysregulation of thought, of emotion, of behavior. And that's basically what the whole field of psychiatry is about, is not that the field is dysregulated, although some of it might say that, but we're talking about dysregulation of our clientele, right? And that's really what you're looking for. So sometimes, you know, a family intervention in the first step of saying what's going on in the family is happening. And I've seen examples where maybe some of my colleagues would have put a kid on medications for something that was dysregulated. But in my experience, what I do is I assess the family overall, and rather than pathologize the kid, I say, what's happening in the family? And, you know, the parents have the courage to go deep inside of what each parent is going through separately. So they don't have to feel like they're revealing something, they don't feel ready to reveal their kid. And often we'll discover something going on that is leading a kid to kind of live out an unresolved issue in a parent. Not always, but sometimes. And then there's no medication needed. There's just an alteration. And we have everybody come together and we figure out what the child was soaking in from the family that was leftover business. Mary Hartzell and I used to call it leftover garbage. You know, it's in severe, more intense ways that you can call it leftover loss or leftover trauma. In one case, I'm thinking about a family where a mom had a loss when she was a child of her mom dying. And so for her daughter, I mean, she had to make sure that daughter was going to be safe and make sure the daughter was going to be this and that. And so when the daughter hit adolescence, it was just the mother projecting unresolved grief over the death of her own mom, which was so sad that she had never worked on. Because she would say, when we've had our first session, try to work on this, the past is the past. What's the point of looking at it? You can't change the past. And what I told her, which I'll say here, is that, yeah, you can't change the past, but you can change how the past impacts you by making sense of it in your life. And she said, well, it doesn't make sense that my mom died. I said, you're absolutely right. And we can make sense of how something that didn't make sense impacted you. And then she starts crying and crying, and crying for the first time ever. And her husband had never seen her cry like that before. So all this stuff came out. And so she was just so understandably vigilant about the health of her daughter, that her daughter was becoming, you might say, obsessive compulsive was what another clinician diagnosed, obsessive compulsive disorder to the daughter. But it was actually, the daughter was living out her mother's worst fears, was that horrible things would befall her daughter like befell her mom. And the mother-daughter relationship would be broken. So she was, you know, unintentionally projecting all this unresolved grief onto her daughter. So it was deep family work. And the, you know, we have a system in the brain, you know, that's called the checker system. The daughter, this adolescent girl, she was 14, her checker system was hugely overactivated. And another patient had come up with this cool name for OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, overactive checker deployment. And you can totally understand the syndrome of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, as this healthy, natural, protective network in the brain is just overactively deployed. So it's overactive checker deployment. And so she was constantly checking for danger. Well, no kidding. Her mom was like wanting her, not wanting consciously her to do that. But so we worked this through, and there was a lot of tears. You had to go through a lot of pain. And then there could be a more faces flow of the family. Flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. So this 14-year-old could, you know, become the now 30-year-old, you know, that she had become, because she could see she didn't have to live out her mother's unspoken, unresolved grief, which was terrible to lose your mom at that age, right? So anyway, so sometimes you have to just be with what is in a family. But then sometimes there is, whether it's from exposure to the Streptococcus bacteria, you know, and you get the part of your brain activated because you've had a strep infection that leads to, you know, infection-based obsessive compulsive disorder. Some people inherit that, just, you know, seem to have a genetic predisposition to it. Sometimes kids need to be on medications for that. I just would be super cautious about, you know, jumping to simple conclusions about diagnostic categories that just label a kid. And then, you know, in the end, you know, sometimes medications help, but they don't cure anything. Deep psychotherapy can go to the root of some things. And sometimes you have therapy with medications, because there are disorders, like, for example, manic depressive illness. You know, as far as we can tell, it does not have an attachment basis whatsoever. It is not due to trauma. It looks like it's inherited dysregulation of certain areas of the brain that regulate emotion. And once it gets started, it kind of revs up and kindles its own mania and depression and mania and depression. And so doing early intervention would be important with medications, which one of them would include lithium. And the stabilization of the membranes that lithium allows, you know, allows a child with bipolar disorder to go from incredible dysregulation and suffering inside of themselves and anyone who cares about them to being stabilized and feeling like they can rely on their own mind. So there's an example. There might be other things going on in the family, but for that individual, they're going to need medication to stabilize their dysregulated mood. And there's a beautiful book by my teacher of manic depressive illness. Her name is Kay Jameson. And she came out years after she was my teacher that she herself has manic depressive illness. And her book is amazing, called An Unquiet Mind.
I've read that. Yeah.
Familiar. Great book.
Yeah. And listen, there's no shame in having a brain that has atypicality to it, which could include dysregulated emotions. And sometimes you need medications to help regulate you. That's just the way it is. Sometimes people have asthma. They need asthma medication. Sometimes people have diabetes. They need diabetes medications, you know? Medications are not the bad guy. It's just we shouldn't use them unless they're really needed.
And so, Dan, you know, you're a professional yourself, and you train lots of professionals. And I think one of the questions that we get, and you probably get this as well often, is how do I know when it's time? How do I know it's time to go see a professional? How do I know that the dysregulation is at a point where reading a book's not going to do it, or listening to another video, or talking to my friends, doing more work on myself? Like, how do I know when that time is to take the next step and start to explore professional?
Yes. And what if, because of finances or whatever other circumstance, a professional might not be available? That's my follow-up question.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Easy questions. Yes. Very important questions. Those two questions. So the one thing to say is, you know, there are very concerning issues that every parent has on their mind anyway, before I'm even saying them, which is about suicide. And unfortunately, these days, we also have about murder. So let's just say it. Some kids coming in adolescence, you know, a lot of, sadly, these individuals that are committing these murders in schools are themselves still in adolescence. I think almost all of them, maybe there's an exception or two, are less than 25. So they're still in their adolescence. The brain is remodeling itself. And, you know, different things can create those conditions. It's a long, long, long story. But and in the big picture, if you look at the discrepancies in our society of racism and the economic troubles we're having, you look at the exposure to violence in all sorts of ways. And some people are concerned about medication use because certain medications like SSRIs can release suicidal ideation and behavior and violent behavior. So, you know, these are issues just to be very, very aware of. And if you have any concern that your child is accumulating weapons, you know, or looking in the internet and looking at ways of hurting themselves or others, you know, these reach the red flag level of urgent care is needed by professionals. So that's the first thing to say. For suicide, I mean, it's a very serious thing. The suicide rate is for children even is going up in this country. And, you know, there's a concern about why that is. And, you know, it's still up in the air about the reason. But some of the things people generally talk about are people are feeling very disconnected. So instead of the relational connections that let us feel whole and seen, and do the three S's of attachment, seen, soothed, and safe, everybody's on their, you know, objects and on their screens. And this is before artificial intelligence. And so, you know, now we have, you know, this moment in human history where we're incredibly relational creatures, where we're spending way more time on screens than in front of faces, right? So the faces flow, we've been talking about a flexible, adaptive, et cetera, you know, comes out when you have face-to-face time. And I've seen a number of families where everybody's on their screens all the time, even at meals. So when you feel empty and alone, you know, depending on your propensity, and it may have to do with your temperament, I don't know, I just wrote a whole book for professionals about this in general terms, but it's just an important question, what your child's temperament may be to become anxious and fearful, or to become sad and depressed, or to become angry and intensely agitated, you know, may depend on their temperament. But if the conditions are such that they're feeling isolated and disconnected, it could be a risk factor for them being driven more and more into one of those lanes, anger, sadness, or fear. And they come out looking very different. External aggression, internal depletion called depression, or worry and fear, you know, called an anxiety disorder. And so you may see these three, the main ways we see dysregulation presenting itself. And if you think it's gone where you can't just sit down and talk to your kid, then reaching out to professional help may be necessary. But the first step is just talk to them. How are you doing? What's going on? I don't want to talk. Well, that makes me concerned. You don't want to talk. I just want to hang with you. Let's go. Let's watch a TV show. Let's watch a comedy. Let's go for a walk around the block with the dog. You know, and if your child is isolating, it doesn't mean you need to talk to them. Sometimes it's better to talk to them, not looking in their face, but having face-to-face time, meaning you're walking around the block with a dog, and they'll talk to you a lot more than if they're looking at you because they feel very like it's too intense. So just making sure you maintain that connection. I try to walk parents through this with Brainstorm, even though it's written for adolescents themselves to read. You can peek into it about how do you keep those connections alive. You know, so, you know, if after doing all that, reaching out, you feel like your child's withdrawn, these things have a kind of a self-reinforcing loop where, you know, if a kid is angry, they get angrier and angrier, and then their anger pushes their friends away, their family away, and they're more and more isolated with anger. So what could have started out with a little bit of anger and you could have intervened gets generated in a big way. Same thing with depression, same thing with the fear and anxiety. So you really want to, you know, try to reach out and connect with your kid before it gets that far along. But the way the brain responds to it, it may be, this is up for, you know, research, but it may be that, you know, they've taken themselves down a path so far out of the faces flow of harmony that they're busy into chaos or flipping into rigidity. And then you really need to do an intervention. And some kids are so far along, you know, they need medications or they need hospitalization. If there's any concern the clinician has, you know, about them really not being able to respond well at home, they may need to be taken out of the school situation, whether it's an eating disorder, or an anxiety disorder, or an identity disorder, or a thought disorder, or a mood disorder. These are all the kinds of things we work with clinically. And in terms of your question, Cecilia, about, you know, what happens if there aren't enough funds or you're in a place where it's not available, I don't have an easy answer to that. I think the relationships that we have as parents are the place to start. So if kids feel like they have a, you know, John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth used to call it a safe haven, you know, for where your kid can go, even if they're in a troubled place. So you can bring your cold state of mind and say, look, I'm here for you. I don't know exactly what's going on, but let's hang out. Let's go walk around the block. If you have a dog, or walk around the house with the dog, watch a funny movie, just hang with your kid, take time, be with them, show up, as Tina Payne Bryson and I wrote in the book, Power of Showing Up, show up for them and just be with them. And you'll see, you know, soon whether what's going on has reached such an extreme that you need to get some help. And, you know, hopefully we will come to realize in this country that we are a community and we need each other. And nuclear families should not be assuming that the way to do things is everyone does this on their own. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. We are meant to live in communities. You know, I can give you a whole biological defense of why living in a collective way as a community of citizens in your city, in your state, in your country, is the civilized way to go. You know, I mean, I forgot who said this, so I'm quoting somebody or paraphrasing them, but they said basically the sign of a civilization is how it cares for the most vulnerable. Children, adolescents, and the elderly, and the infirm. And so you can ask yourself the question, is this a civilized nation we're living in?
Yeah.
And you come up with your own answer.
Yeah.
And next time it's time for an election, think about voting a leader who can promote a civilization that supports the marginalized, the most vulnerable. We're here for each other, and we need societal structures that support that.
Yeah. We've been talking a bunch in this conversation and in many of the conversations that we've had with you in the past about different things that affect the brain development. What are, and some of the struggles there, we are living in a pretty unique time, feels like to me, where the things stacked up against kids and families are significant. What are the things that give you hope? Or what are the things that parents can do to, that maybe we haven't talked about yet, to counterbalance all the things that feel like they're stacked up against?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Cecilia. Thank you. You know, my partner in life, Caroline Welch, wrote a fantastic book called The Gift of Presence, A Mindfulness Guide for Women. So men who've read it are crazy about this book. They love this book. The women are over the moon for this book. And what Caroline did in the book was talk about purpose, right, in a deep way, and the relationship of presence to purpose and prioritizing things, and then sometimes you needing to pivot. I think in that book, you'll see a guideline, not to just what you do individually, but beautiful wisdom teachings about what we need to do as a collective family. So here in your summit, for example, you can have people find each other and start building parent groups, and not just support groups, but action groups. And the action you can take is you can start building structures that build on what I was taught years ago is a great academic phrase, but it's called pervasive leadership, where you don't have to wait for some elected official or some president of some company or some CEO of some corporation to decide on what's going to affect your life. you can be empowered through this summit to say, you know, here's what we can do. And so what gives me hope is that human beings, while we are capable of incredible, you know, competition and destructive ways that we deal with each other, we're also incredibly capable of collaboration, creativity, caring, and compassion. And we have both sides. You see this every day in the news. You see this in the neighborhood. We go both ways. So, you know, my hope is that we each can reach in and say, we have a choice, actually. Do we live in isolation and disconnection and the opposite of cold? I don't know what it would be if closed-minded instead of, well, no, the opposite of curiosity would be opinionatedness, fixed opinions. The opposite of openness would be closed-mindedness. The opposite of acceptance would be what?
Rejection.
Rejection, yeah, rejectedness, that's a word. And the opposite of love would, I guess, be hate.
Hatred.
Or indifference, yeah. Or even indifference. Indifference mm-hmm. and hate, both those being equally the opposite of love. You know, and so to have a cold way to live as a community is realizing, you know, I say this all the time because we've talked about it before, to remember that you say, you're not just a me, you're also a we. And, you know, I wrote a whole book called Interconnected, trying to show the science of this. But the take-home message of that long book, you know, is that if we can raise our kids and also ourselves as parents to live this way, is I'm a me in this body, sure. But who I am is also a we. My relationships with Cecilia and Jason and everyone on the summit, my relationships with all human beings, not just the ones in my family and my friends, but all human family, and my relationships with all living beings. That's what we mean by we. And not just here now, but our descendants, seven generations past, as indigenous teachings tell us, seven generations that came before. That's the we, right? So you go, I'm a me and a we, and we say the funny word, muy. So then if we can live that way, then you would naturally have groups that you would form. Because you realize the body is not the only source of your identity. And when in an individualistic culture, where the United States is the most extreme of individualistic cultures, we know that individualism is directly related to mental unhealth. Mental suffering directly increases as individuality, but that's not the right word, an individualistic way of living gets intensified. You see this in Sweden, for example. Sweden used to have the highest rates of mental health. 50 years ago, something changed in the culture, and it became one of the most individualistic cultures around, emulating the United States. Now they have some of the worst mental health in the world. Sweden.
Huh.
I was just there, and people were telling me this, and we went over the data, right? So I say this to you because we know what the answer is. When there's just me, 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 me of individualism, people feel isolated. Then they get what's called the hedonic treadmill, where you say, okay, the master narrative of my culture is telling me that the purpose of life, which is not true, but it's what I'm told, the purpose of life is to accumulate things. So then I get 1,000 things, whether it's dollars in my bank account or, you know, size of my car or whatever. I'm really not happy. I don't have meaning in my life. I don't have a sense of purpose. I feel really, oh, you know what it is? I didn't get enough stuff. Maybe the 1,000 was just too little. I'll try for 10,000. I work. Now I've got the 10,000. And now I come to see you, Jason and Cecily, and I say, Cecilia, look, I'm not making any sense. I've got 10,000 things. And you go, well, maybe there's something else. You're right. I leave you. Now I want to go for 1,000,000 things. So now I've worked for 1,000,000 things. And they come see somebody else. I'm still unhappy. Oh, maybe you have depression. Maybe you have anxiety. Well, maybe you're listening to the master narrative of individualistic cultural statements of which are basically teaching us a lethal lie that who we are is a separate self. So, of course, you have a body that has a me identity to it. Feed your body well, enjoy your body, relax your body, stretch your body, exercise your body. That's all me, me, me. Fine. No one is saying get rid of the individual side of the fullness of who you are. But the other side of who you are is a we. So go out and be of service to other people, not just your family and friends. That's a good place to start, but your community. See if you can be a part of helping the health of people who are part of this country, other species, you know? And then you're going to get a sense, as Caroline Welch talks about, purpose. And then you're going to get what Angela Duckworth talks about, which is grit. And then you say, bring it on. You know, I'm going to have the persistence to pursue what I feel is right. And you'll stop listening to the lie of the separate self and all the hedonic treadmill we get on to try to accumulate more and more stuff, which only makes you have this empty feeling inside that you continue to live the narrative of the lie, trying to fill the emptiness with something that is absolutely in the wrong direction. Stuff is not going to make you happy. Now, let's be clear. We need a minimal amount so we're safe, so we have food, so we have protection, for sure. So we're not saying just go live out on the street, you know, unless that's your choice. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that the perpetual seeking of more and more, the perpetual drive to not only accumulate, but keep on figuring out ways to get other people to want what you're selling so they can have more stuff. Think about all the clever people that are trying to get our kids addicted through social media, right? It's just about dollars. When you get those eyeballs on a screen because you figured out how to get those kids addicted to social media and all the other things that are around, it's just dollars. They're buying a lot of stuff. You know, so we can pull away from that and say, I will no longer participate in the often American-based and American-originated lie of the separate self because it's a lethal lie. And people just are soaking that lie in like it's truth. And there's something in my field, I'm an attachment researcher, called epistemic trust, where you trust the people who are telling you things to be true. There's massive violations now of epistemic trust. People in positions of power, whether it's in governments or companies, are just doing all sorts of stuff to our minds to make us unhealthy. That's what the research is super clear about. So then what happens is people say, researchers are dumb, universities are stupid, science makes no sense. It's all just an opinion and has no validity, doing careful controlled studies about what is healthy for you or not, it doesn't matter. So then everyone feels anxious. Wow, I think I'm being told a lie. No kidding. And what that does to your body is create incredible anxiety. That's what our kids are experiencing. This is before we're even talking about artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So Cecilia, I have taken a question of hope and I'm trying to have it a question of informed hope. My wonderful colleague and friend, Joanna Macy, who just passed, had a great book called Active Hope. And she would say about what I'm saying, you go for it, Dan, because unless we have what she called the great turning, where we turn away from the prior narrative of separation and that material accumulation equals the meaning of life, unless we do the great turning away from those lies, it doesn't really matter what you do. Your kid is going to enter an insane world and go, wow, something feels insane. And you're going to go, oh my God, what's wrong with my kid? It's that your kid is picking up accurately. The culture they're entering is nuts. So you have the opportunity as parents to teach the truth. Meaning in life comes from love, from truly connecting with other people, from having a sense of purpose and meaning that arises as you figure out how you're going to take this connection, these relational connections, and turn them into health. And so your kid can have, at least in your home, a sanctuary of sanity in the face of a world, and now with artificial intelligence, that is going to take away their jobs. It's going to take away their hope for the future about how they're going to be employed. So there's got to be, literally, Joanna, if she were here right now, she would say, yeah, we need now more than ever before a great turning so that people can know what has true meaning, what gives you true happiness, what helps you go in that faces flow, so that we as parents can say, let's talk about the truth And that is the world out there, which is telling us lies, including what social media is saying. So this is your opportunity as parents. I know it's a tall order. I get it. And I know it would have been easier to say, just eat cornflakes. That's all you need to do. You know, I wish I could say something like that. I'd go get the cornflakes right now. I like cornflakes, so nothing, I'm not putting down cornflakes. But what I'm saying is, with a little thoughtfulness and a lot of relationality, we can all achieve that coal state and give that to our kids, because times, I think, have never been more filled with possibility at the same time as they're incredibly rough out there. The world is a really, really rough place. So we have to have this active hope, Joanna would have called it, and we have to have this way of finding a balance inside of ourselves and saying, we were built for these times. And it doesn't mean just accepting what the master narrative is telling us, but actually have the courage to stand up and say, actually, our sense of what is meaningful in life is different from what the culture is telling us. And that's what I'm going to convey to my kids. And they can think about it on their own. But when they hit adolescence and they know this is a sanctuary in our home where we talk about the truth and we don't just pretend like what all those messages from out there are saying is actually making any sense, we can talk about that. I know that's hard to do because we want the world to be a nice, safe place where everything makes sense. But actually, it's a nutty place. It's rough and nutty. It's violent. And the hope comes from seeing the truth.
Dan, this has been such a great, wide-ranging conversation. In particular, I appreciate how you address hope and the possibility for parents to change the world through parenting. It's, you know, one of the things we believe in strongly. It's part of why we do what we do. And I'm sure it's part of why you do what you do, because you've got such a huge influence worldwide with professionals and with parents. And as we're wrapping up, is there any final words that you would like to have for folks that are here, or anything else that you wanted to cover before we wrap up?
You know, I think this is an incredible time to be a parent. I think it's an incredible time to be a person. It's requiring a lot of us, for sure. We need to see every challenge as an invitation. And I said this to Joanna Macy before she passed, and I'll say it here. You know, if we see all these difficulties that in the world that we're facing as threats, we're going to burn out. It's going to feel too much. We're just going to turn on the TV, which I love watching movies. Don't get me wrong. It's a great way to relax. And I'm fascinated with film, so I love that. But we're just going to want to distract ourselves rather than stay present. So what I said to Joanna, which I'll say here, is we need to change from that threat mindset, which will lead to burnout because we're going to fight, flee, freeze, faint in a collapse, or fawn and just deal with our, you know, the aggressors in ways of just, you know, disappearing. Instead, we want to change from that threat set of mindsets to a challenge mindset. And what I said to Joanna, and I was dancing with her on her patio, you know, a few years before she passed, she was 92 at the time. You know, I said, look, you got to wake up every morning. You see what the news is telling you, and you see it as a dance partner, that these challenges, instead of threats, they're challenges. And the challenge mindset says, bring it on. And then you dance with the challenge. It's your dance partner. She was laughing and laughing and laughing. And, you know, I was with her the last day she was speaking before she stopped speaking and then passed. It was beautiful because she was 96 when she died. But she is a lesson to all of us on how you can be really fully present and still have a hopeful, she called it active hope, not just blind, naive hope, but active hope, which says, and this is the way I would define hope, I can see possibilities beneath the surface appearance of things. And so what, you know, Jason, what we're talking about, you know, and Cecilia, what we're talking about in terms of hope is these possibilities come from the great turning that Joanna Macy invited us to consider. You as parents have the opportunity to actually cultivate that great turning in your family and start talking about the real meaning of life. Now, that may require you, think about it. Why are you here? What are you doing here? Well, you might say, I'm here to accumulate stuff and give my stuff to my kids so they can get more stuff. Okay. Well, then you're going to be stuffed up. and just think how that's working for you, you know? So then you say, okay, well, it's not about accumulating stuff. What is it about? Well, if listening to this summit makes you question, oh my God, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? Now, if you're religious, you may have that God gave you reason. Great. I don't think in various formal religions, it says the purpose of you being here is to create more stuff and get more stuff. I don't think. Maybe I'm misinformed. But what is it? It's about loving. The deep teachings of all the world's religions are loving. The deep teachings of all the contemplative practices are it's loving. Indigenous teaching is loving. It's love is the fabric of the universe. And that's what it's about. And love is about linking. It's about connecting, right? It's the fourth letter of our call thing. So be curious, be open, be accepting, be loving. And we can do the great turning that Joanna asked us to try to make happen. And there's no better place to start than today with you and your children.
Thanks, Dan. We love you. We love what you've done for us throughout the world, all the parents. And thank you for spending the time here with us. If people want to know more about what you have, all the books that you've got out there, all the content that you have, the classes that you have.
How they can connect with you at events.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Got some live events coming.
We have two websites. The first, Dr. Dan Siegel. So drdansiegel.com. So that website, you'll see links to stay. If you want to come in person, you know, some of them are for professionals, but a lot of them are for the public. We have in-person events all over the world in different settings. Some are online, but some of them are like in-person, like actual things. You can come on rivers, go to islands, be on the beach, all sorts of fun things, and hanging out for a week together in one of those water-related areas. I like water. I channel my inner otter, so you're going to see me swimming a lot. So come join us in one of those water-based events. You know, or if you like to read books, there are different books recommended, different educational things. If you want deep training, you can go to the MindSight Institute, the second website. And there's, you know, it's focused on professionals, but anybody can take them. There's deep dives into parenting issues, into therapy issues, attachment issues, you know. And so there you'll have a comprehensive training available to you at the MindSightInstitute.com.
Thank you.
And that's MindSight. Mind and then like seeing the mind, mindsight.com, institute.com.
And we'll put the links for both of those in the speaker notes so people
Great.
Can get to that. And we appreciate you taking the time here to talk to us and having a nice deep conversation. It's great to have that. It's great to talk about big topics with you and to be talking about community and love and what we can do in times that are somewhat challenging, not just as parents, but as community members of the world. So thank you for that. Thank you for this time. As always, it's good talking to you.
And great talking to you.
We're built for this, right?
We're built for this. We are built for these times. And together, because it's better together, you know, we can and we will make this great turning happen.
Awesome. Thank you very much. We look forward to talking again in the future. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.